Welcome to the DermVet Podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bourgeois, a board-certified veterinary dermatologist practicing in Portland, Oregon with animal dermatology clinics. I'm also a mom of two, just trying to find the balance like everyone else. Let's learn to ditch the itch, cytology, everything, and make derm more fun than frustrating. Well, we have a really fun episode of the podcast today, and I was very excited to have Dr. Andrea Hernandez join me, and she actually is a first-year resident at Animal Dermatology Clinic in Tustin, California, which is very sentimental to me because that's where I did my own residency. But she wanted to come on and talk about various dermatology myths and different myths that we need to bust and really take the time to educate our clients on. So we go through a lot of information and really important topics that we all hear in the clinic from our clients quite often, and how to really take our time and educate about these topics without coming off defensive or frustrated. So I really hope you guys enjoy this episode of the DermVet Podcast. Thank you guys so much for coming to another episode of the DermVet Podcast. I am very excited to have Dr. I'm going to try to say it the Puerto Rican way. Andrea, is that close?
Yes.
That's Hernandez.
Perfect. Yes. Perfect.
So, yay. I'm trying. I'll work on it. Dr. Hernandez is actually a first year resident with our company Animal Dermatology Clinic at the Orange County location, which is near and dear to my heart because that is where I did my own residency. But now it's like getting embarrassingly long ago because I am slowly aging up there. But Dr. Hernandez, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, it'll be fun. And everyone should know that they should follow you on Instagram and TikTok. And are those the two main ones? The two main ones. Because she is hilarious. And whereas I like to put out content, I cannot compete with the reels and the TikToks. And I'm going to try to figure it out because everyone keeps making fun of me, but I'm definitely not going to compare to the very fun educational content that you put out there. So I definitely enjoy seeing what you do. You have a lot of fun with it, but it also like really helps to educate, which is super helpful too. And yes. Then what is your handle on Instagram? It's
it's AHB underscore Derma Vet.
So, okay. AHB. Yeah. So like your initials, Derma Vet. Mm-hmm. Okay. Perfect. Well, I think this will be a really fun episode of the podcast. And this isn't actually an idea that you had, and that was to kind of discuss, I guess they're myth busters. That's kind of like taking a very general term that people use, but just really common things that we might hear from our clients and, how do we approach those things? How do we debunk them? So I think we'll get a really good mix of information, but also like the communication aspect, which is really important. You know, we can know these things. We can know that some of these things aren't true, but we have to really, in a kind way, teach our clients that because, we need them on our side. So it's really important that we really take our time to educate clients and not necessarily be defensive if they bring up something that, we know is not true. Yes. So I think it'll be really fun. So we're going to just jump in. Like we're not tiptoeing into these. None of them really are super easy. But let's just start with the age old question. And even if we ignore like the cardiac disease portion of grain-free diets. So let's say we have a client come in, it's a really young dog, and they say, you mentioned doing a diet trial. And they say, well, my dog's been fed a grain-free diet. I've avoided grain. So I've already worked up food allergy. Like, what are your thoughts behind that? And how do you approach that with your client?
So I think this is a really good topic to talk about because there's definitely a lot of misinformation, not only on the internet, but when clients go to pet stores, there's a lot of marketing behind these. And a lot of pet food companies have jumped on the grain-free boat and they just get all this information thrown at them. And I always think, like to think that they're doing what's best for their pet. There's in no way that they're doing this with bad intentions. So I always approach it the educational way. I tell them, hey, like, there's a lot of misconceptions towards grain-free diets. There's a lot of false information on the internet, and in pets, it's very, very, I don't tell them that it's impossible, but it's very, very rare for a dog or a cat to have a grain allergy. And a lot of times these pets have been on a grain-free diet for so long and their pets are not getting any better. So that's how I try to open up the discussion and tell them, hey, you've been trying this grain-free diet for a while. Let's actually approach it the traditional way. Like, we mainly see pets being allergic to protein, the protein source, and let's do a proper diet trial. And yeah, that's mainly how I take an approach to it.
I think it's really important. Something you said was more kind of starting out that educational standpoint. You know, when we think about clients coming in and saying these things that we know aren't true and can be really, you know, a little frustrating and disheartening for us, because we do know a lot of it. You're right. It's based on marketing. It's based on hearsay, kind of what people read on the internet. But I really think how you start is important. And that is, their intentions are good. So sometimes it's really easy to hear, you know, we'll hear the same thing all the time and we'll want to eye roll. We'll want to be frustrated. Like, well, how could they even think that? I'm so sick of people thinking that. But yeah, the reality is they don't know. Like, you know, marketing works on people. I just bought these like semi-cured gel nail sticker things that I'm going to try out because I got marketed to, and they could be completely terrible. And I don't know, but marketing is really good and that's their job. So, you know, I think it's important that you mention that, that even if it's frustrating, you have to give them the benefit of the doubt and just say, you know, the intention was good. They don't know. Like, this is not their education. And of course you have clients that you start going through that education part and they don't listen, or, you know, they're a bit more defensive about it. But I will say, I feel like a majority actually really do listen. You know, they'll kind of take what you say if you say it in a very kind way and it's not impossible. I like to tell owners, like, you know, I don't want to miss something that we could easily control with just a dietary change. And whenever we talk about changing food, I'll let them know, we can readdress what you want to feed your dog long-term eventually, but we just need to get through this trial portion. And I think just kind of also letting them know, yeah, you're going to get a lot of opinions on food. Like, I might use something different than you, even though we're both in the dermatology field, like, we all have different opinions on it. Here's my thought process on it. Here's why. And I think sometimes when you can explain, hey, if a dietary change can control even a percentage of the symptoms and it allows us to use less medication long term, that's super beneficial for us. And I don't want to miss that. If we get to the end of it and you really commit to those, you know, I do 8 weeks. If you commit to those 8 weeks and at the end of it, it's made no difference, great. Well, then at least we've crossed that off just the list, just like anything else we'd need to work up and cross off the list. So I think coming from that aspect of, you know, not being defensive, but realizing they're really trying to help, this is not where they're educated to know, you know, these myths that they're not true, is really important.
Yeah.
Do you find that most people will do the diet if you kind of explain it to them?
Yeah. I was actually going to say that what you just talked about, saying, like, telling them, let's rule this out first, because sometimes it depends on the way that you present it to them. Cause if you tell them, oh, we have to do a diet trial for 2 to 3 months or 8 to 12 weeks, they're probably going to be like, oh, that sounds like forever. I don't want to put my pet through that and change their diet. But the way that you educate them and you present it, I get most of the clients that come in, they're like, hey, why not? Yeah, let's try it. And even if they've been on a previous diet trial with a different diet and I highly suspect a food allergy, I even tell them, I think we should consider doing a second diet trial. And I always give them that that point that it's a food, it's easier to avoid it than to just have them stay with this food, put them on all these medications. And if we find out what they're allergic to in the diet, we can easily avoid that ingredient. So, and I don't always do individual ingredient challenges. I don't know if you do that with your patients. I guess it depends on the client most of the time. Like if they want to figure out exactly what they're allergic to, I do. But if not, I just challenge them with their old diet.
Yeah, I would say if I'm going to challenge just to see if food matters or not, because we could have done the diet trial during a season change. They could be on, you know, medications that are masking their symptoms. So I agree. I like to challenge them with what they've been on, because if they got better and when what we fed them on, they were itchy on before, and we give it back to them and nothing happens, well, then it's probably not the food. If you just go straight to individual ingredient challenges right away, assuming they're better, like you don't really know. Cause what if they're chicken allergic and you know, you start with like beef. So for the yes or no, I like the previous diet, just like you, super client-based. Like I'd say most people don't end up diving that far into individual ingredient challenges. I've had some who totally do, and we can go through the list and go through the process of that. But you know, for the most part, pets aren't only food allergic. I know they exist, and I know there's, you know, some dermatologists who live and breathe by food allergy. I kind of say they're out there, but it's not super common to have that be the sole allergy. So when you're also talking about having to look through, well, what's their environmental flare versus the food flare? Like most people, if they find a diet they do well on and we've confirmed they're food allergic, kind of just stay put. I don't know if that's kind of what you've noticed too.
Yeah, that's my experience as well.
Yeah. Well, then going based off that, so you kind of mentioned like protein source and individual ingredient challenges. Let's go to the other really kind of common thing we hear about food. And that is, say, a young cat or dog, and you start talking to them about a diet trial. It doesn't even have to be young. Say it's like an older pet. And they say, oh, well, I cut out all chicken. Like I fed it, you know, I found a diet over the counter that was lamb-based. I cut all chicken, so I don't think it can be a food allergy. And I feel like I hear that one pretty commonly on an initial exam. How do you approach that conversation?
Absolutely. I get that a lot in the initial appointments. We have this form, and I guess you guys have it too, that clients fill out like different questions that we make. And a lot of them always make the comment, we've cut out chicken, I'm feeding them turkey, or I'm feeding them duck now, or venison, and they're not getting any better. So I always approach that with telling them that chicken is not the only potential allergen in food. I start with that. I tell them that any protein source can cause an allergy in food allergies. We blame the poor chicken all for allergies all the time.
Well, we blame chicken because it really is a lot of times a problem.
It is. It really is. It's gotten a bad rep.
But not 100% of the time. Sure.
Not 100% of the time.
Yeah.
But there's definitely other possibilities. So I always tell them, hey, I've had pets before that when we confirm a food allergy in the past, rarely, they flare to certain types of fish protein, like salmon or beef. A lot of them tend to flare to beef as well. Beef is another pretty common protein. And that's what I start with. I tell them, let's actually further explore this, because chicken may not be the only issue. There may be something else. And when I start talking about that, I also bring up the fact that certain proteins can cross-react with others. So if they are feeding, let's say, turkey or duck, I like to educate clients on cross-reactivity, like the proteins of the poultry family, they can cross-react with each other, or beef can cross-react with bison or venison. And then I further dive in into other facts about doing diet trials and diagnosing food allergies. Like if they only cut out chicken or just feed them an over-the-counter diet that doesn't have any chicken in it, I also tell them that there's also a possibility of cross-contamination, especially with over-the-counter diets. And that has been proven before in studies done in the past. So that's usually what I start. And a lot of them are very receptive. Like when I tell them, hey, there's other proteins that can cause allergies, most clients are like, oh, really? I didn't know that. That's good to know. And they're very receptive to the information most of the time.
Yeah. And there's a few things you brought up I think are super important. The cross reaction. So, you know, we do see a lot of pets that come in on things, like you said, like duck or turkey. And it's not that those can't work. Like, there are certainly pets that will respond to those. However, we do know that there are cross reactions. So, you know, if you're poultry allergic, yes, like you could be allergic to things like duck and turkey. Just like we see cross reaction with certain pollens when we're formulating immunotherapy, we see cross reaction with food sources. And so if owners like really think, you know, oh, but they love the duck and want to stay on it, that's again where we can go back to, well, if we do a different diet trial for 8 weeks, we confirm the food allergy. We can always come back to a different food. If you really think they just love duck and can never be without it, like we could do an individual ingredient challenge eventually or try a different food. And the other thing I think that's really important was you mentioning kind of the other protein sources that can be in foods. And, you know, we'll get clients that come in and say, well, they were on chicken and now, you know, you can find almost any protein source over the counter, which makes novel protein diet trials
very difficult.
They're very difficult because you have to get a full history. And, you know, you used to get away with a lot of these protein sources and now you can find them in anything. So I've had owners come in and say, well, I switched them to rabbit and it was just like an over-the-counter diet. You know, the first thing I like to say is like, because people want to get defensive of food, right? It's like what they've chosen to feed their animal. It's like a sign of love. Like, you know, we make food for each other and cook and have these holidays with surrounded around food because it's like love. So it can be a little, clients get defensive of that. Like, oh, you're saying what I have chosen has been wrong.
Yeah.
So I always like to say like, you know, unless it's some crazy grain-free cardiac, like causing problem, I don't know, like diet, like that's not a bad food. It just depends on what you're allergic to. And then that can kind of help clients realize I'm not like blaming you for that food. It's like when you're older and all of a sudden you develop a shellfish allergy, like it just matters. It's not a bad quality food. It just matters what you're allergic to. And I'm just worried that they could have developed an allergy to that protein source. The other important thing is demonstrating why these prescription diets are more expensive. So like you mentioned, making sure there's no other protein sources in there. So I've said it before in the podcast, but I think it's really important. Like, I think it's really beneficial to relate it to humans for people because they can think about that. So the classic easy example is the nut allergy. Like, we almost all know some child, whether it's a family member or a friend or, you know, someone that has a nut allergy. And then we all see the, you know, my kid's daycare is nut free. Like we can't pack anything with nuts in it on the off chance that there's a kid with a nut allergy. So I'll explain to owners, like, you know, when you see that label that says this is made in a facility that also contains nuts, like, these prescription diets are more expensive because they're going through, they have specific cleaning protocols they have to do. They have specific ELISA testing they do to assure that there's no other protein sources within that food. What is on the label is exactly what's on the food. And that's really helpful for owners to know why. It doesn't mean they want to spend $100 on a bag of food, but if they know why, like, it's not just because it's a specific company and they like to charge a lot for food. It's like, they have to pay for all that stuff to be done. And you know, you can say it in a way that's easy, relatable, and then give them an out. So, hey, if we get through this diet trial at the end of 8 weeks, they're no better. Excellent. We move on. Even if it did make them better. And that is just not a realistic food for you to feed your huge Great Dane and the rest of their life financially.
Yeah.
We can figure it out from there, but at least we'll know it matters. And then we can look at the option. So whenever I talk about food, I think that's really important, like education to the clients, you know, why these prescription diets are more expensive and validate that for them, but also give them an out, just like get them through the diet trial. More often than not, if their dog does or cat does a lot better on the food and they realize they're not paying for so many vet visits and so many cytologies, like they're saving that money. Most owners are willing to actually stay on it if they see the benefit from it. Is that what you kind of think too?
Yeah. And that's what I think as well. I also bring up the fact of why these foods are more expensive, and it's for that same reason. And I agree. I feel like a pretty big majority of my clients that I put their pet on a diet trial, they if they get a little bit better, they're like, hey, you know what? He actually really likes this food. He eats it really well, or she eats it really well. So I'm going to keep them on it. And they even ask me, is it okay if I keep them on it? Can I do it? And absolutely they can. So.
Yeah. I had a client the other day that's like, they just did so well on this diet. And it was one of the prescription hydrolyzed diets. They're like, they've done so well, but I remember you saying they can't stay on that long-term. I was like, I never said that. Yeah. They can definitely stay on it long-term if it's helped. I only put a dog or cat on a food that's balanced. So it's like, absolutely stay on that food.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, that's my dream. Please don't switch the food if they're doing so much better.
Exactly. You make my job much easier.
Yeah, that's right. Like, we're all too busy right now. If we can control the food and, you know, not necessarily have to have as many rechecks right now, perfect for everybody involved. So then shifting away from food. So we know like food's a big thing that we deal with as far as like derm myths, but there's plenty of others. We're definitely not going to cover them all on this podcast. Yeah. So let's go to, you know, I tried this oil. Insert oil name. I tried this coconut oil. I tried this, what have I heard a lot lately? Like tea tree oil. I've tried hemp seed oil. I've tried CBD oil, like, you know, insert the thousands of oils that are out there. And it didn't seem to be helpful, or I want to try this because I think it might be helpful. Where do you go with that? Because that can kind of be a really big discussion and, you know, go against a lot of what's advertised out there.
Yeah, absolutely. The essential oils is a really big topic that I run into quite a lot. Clients either already have the pet on something, like you said, or they ask me about tea tree oil. That's a pretty popular one. Coconut oil. Oh my gosh. If even bad dogs walk in and they are an oily hot mess because they're lathered everywhere with coconut oil. And I like to approach this pretty carefully because the same way I don't want them to feel bad. I don't want them to feel like they're like causing any harm to their pet, even though some of these essential oils, they can potentially cause some harm, especially in cats or in a dog. If they're licking their paws a lot and then they lick the essential oil off, it could potentially cause a lot of issues. So I usually approach it with, hey, there's lot of information out there regarding essential oils and their benefits in allergies and pets. And so we really don't know if it works or not. If they've already had the pet on some type of essential oil or whatever for quite a while and the pet is still doing poorly, I also like tell them, hey, you know what? Let's try something else. Let's try something that we know that it has worked in the past. And a lot of them are very receptive to it because they've been through so much and they're willing to accept a lot of recommendations. But I usually bring up the fact that we need to be a little bit cautious with trying random things because they could potentially be harmful to pets. And when it comes to coconut oil, one thing that I usually bring up to pet owners is that coconut oil, there's really, again, not a lot of information out there that if we know if it's a good emollient or not. And then the other thing that I also educate owners on, or try to at least, is that these allergic pets are very prone to having malassezia overgrowth. And if you're going to lather a very oily substance all over their skin, these organisms, they're highly lipophilic. So they're probably going to proliferate and live in a happy environment and be even harder to clear. So I always give them I recommend like, hey, let's switch it up. If you have an infection, like if I detect an infection or something with cytology, let's switch up your topicals. Let's try something antimicrobial and maybe even add in dermalay spray or an oatmeal based spray that we know that oatmeal actually works pretty well. So, and most of them, they're pretty receptive again to recommendations and, they're pretty willing to change because a lot of these pets come in pretty bad conditions. So that's usually my experience with these topical essential oils and coconut oil. And I really haven't had a lot of clients add coconut oil to the diet, 'cause that's also another thing that I've like through social media, people ask me, can I add coconut oil to my dog's food? Will that help their hair coat? And usually what I tell them is that it can cause GI upset because it's very oily and it can cause a lot of other problems other than skin. So
yeah, I think backing up and just giving them different options is really important. So again, looking at the intentions are good, right? Like they're willing to do topical therapy. So then I say exactly the same, like, we just don't really know. We don't know the content. You know, we don't know the potential side effects that could have. I love the saying about the Malassezia being lipophilic. I might take that. like, cause none of them are going to want to like feed the yeast.
Yeah.
But I love that you want to do topical therapy. So that's great. I think topical therapy actually can be super helpful. And here's why. And here's what I like to use. Like, you know, like you said, certain shampoos that have like chlorhexidine or anti-yeast properties to them, if we need them based on what we saw that day, or if they're not infected, like here's different products that have different epidermal barrier restorative properties to them that are proven. So it's kind of like being like, hey, I love that you want to do topical therapy. I think topical therapy is really important, but let's focus on products we know more about and actually have like the research to back them up. And you know, if they want to do essential oils, you can do products like Dermascent, or you mentioned kind of like the sprays and conditioners. Like there's things beyond bathing that we can do to really help restore that skin. But I think what you said is really key. We don't know. Like, it's okay to say that. And actually, I think clients really respect that. I say that all the time. Like, clients will mention, like, have you heard of this product? I'm like, I'm not familiar with that product because it's some, like, you know, million supplement that is out there that I just can't keep up with. So it's okay to say, I don't know that product, or I don't know that particular diet. There's just so many options out there. Here's the ones that I work with and that I'm more familiar with. And so it's kind of taking like the, hey, I'm really proud and love that you like to do topical, but let's just like focus that on something I have more faith, we know more about, and we can know the effects of that. So I think that's really helpful. And we all know topical therapy is extremely important for our allergic patients.
Yeah.
Moving into, we're going to go into another deep section of the weeds here. It's like food's already kind of the deep section of the weeds, but now we're going to go to the other F word. I can't believe I just said that, but that is fleas. It's kind of entertaining because I actually don't swear, but so F words for me will be food and fleas. Because they're like the things we don't like to talk about.
I love it.
Yeah. This just, we're all raw here on the Derm Vet podcast. Say, you know, we hear, but I don't see fleas, and that's one section itself. Say like owner says, well, I don't see fleas, so it can't be a problem. Or I use this all natural, topical that's supposed to be effective against fleas. So, you know, I don't need prevention. Go.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Where do sorry. I begin? And this will be another 2-hour part of the podcast.
Oh my gosh. Where do I begin?
You can do more like the 10,000 foot view. Like, you know, we can always dive deeper, like a different episode.
Yeah. Yeah. So along the lines of the, I do not see fleas comment usually goes hand in hand with, like owners associating that as an accusation that they're not sanitary. And I don't know if you've had that issue before. Mm-hmm. But when I ask them, hey, do you have your pet on flea prevention? They look at me all baffled, like, no, I don't need that. Like, we don't see any fleas in our house. Like, we don't have a flea infestation. And it's very, I usually take this like pretty delicately because I don't want them to get upset or anything. And I don't mean to upset them at all. I just want what's best for their pet. And especially in cases where I suspect a flea allergy, I start by kind of explaining like, hey, I start with the whole allergy spiel. If I think flea allergy, I try to state right beforehand in the beginning that for a flea allergy dermatitis to happen, you don't need to have a flea infestation. You don't need to see fleas on the pet, because if a pet has a hypersensitivity to it, that can definitely make them very sensitive to just a few bites if they're exposed. So we have to keep them protected. And I also mention owners like, hey, I highly suspect that your pet has allergies, even if flea allergy is not on the top of my list. If your pet is not protected and it's not on flea control, flea bites can actually exacerbate your pet's symptoms. And usually by telling them that, they're actually kind of like pretty receptive to it. They're like, oh, I didn't think of that. That actually makes sense. And when I tell them here in California, there's a ton of fleas. There's fleas everywhere. There's no seasonality to fleas. It's a very happy environment for fleas to proliferate. And even if you have 100% indoor cat inside of the house and they're not on flea control, you think they're protected, you can certainly bring a random flea in your clothes, like especially in the warmer months where here in California, there's fleas year round, but in the warmer months where they're in high, even higher numbers, you can certainly bring a flea in your clothing or in your shoes. If you have a dog in the house and the dog goes out to the yard and then comes in, they can bring something into the house. Same thing with owners that tell me, I have a little dog in the house. They only go outside to pee, to go potty, and they don't stay outside. They don't go to the park or anything. But again, I bring up the fact that here in California, there's a lot of fleas. Certain areas, there are more fleas than others. And even just from going outside, it only takes less than a second for a flea to jump on your pet and take a blood meal. So when I give them that explanation and just provide them the information, most of them are actually pretty good about it. They're like, oh, really? Wow, I didn't think of that. And I forgot what was the other question to the...
using all natural flea products.
Yes. And then with the all natural products here, at least my experience here in California, I haven't really gotten a lot of those, but when I was practicing in Florida, which we're talking about F words, F is for Florida and for fleas.
Florida and fleas. I love and it.
Fleas. I did have several clients that would just bathe their dogs in diatomaceous earth and expect that that would repel fleas and keep their pets protected against fleas. And that was not the case. I would have dogs that would be covered in the little grains of diatomaceous earth and flea dirt. So I educate clients and tell them, hey, there's a long list of products that we can use that they are safe and effective. They've been proven over time that they're very effective. And we want what's best for your pet. We want what's best to get their skin symptoms under control. So I highly recommend switching to this topical flea preventative or this oral flea preventative that it's known to be effective compared to this natural product. And we seem to be finding fleas or we're seeing a possible flea allergy pattern. So it's a pretty in-depth topic. But at least most of them, they're pretty receptive to when we educate them. So,
yeah, I think, you know, speaking from your experience too can be helpful. Like, you know, I've had other patients where they were using diatomaceous earth or some other natural product. And, you know, I have found fleas on them. I think the scary thing that owners don't realize is the adult population of fleas that we see, that's okay. The adults that we see, I'm surprised my dog hasn't barked. So we're doing pretty good. The adults are actually very small population, like of the fleas that are in the environment. Like there can be, I saw a crazy statistic recently that it's like, you know, almost half of like the flea population can be eggs, just like hanging out, waiting, you know, to hatch. And when you actually see fleas, it's a very, very small amount of probably what's truly in the environment, which is scary to think about. Yeah. But I also think what's helpful now is that we do have the isoxazolines, whichever of the four that you use in dogs, or, you know, there's the two in cats because Bravecto and Revolution Plus both have some form of it. You also get the benefit of saying you get protection from other things that can cause itch. So now, you know, besides just having to go with the flea concern, you can say, well, it also is going to protect your pet against, you know, scabies or what, insert name of mite here. So you do get that benefit, especially if you have a really itchy pet that's saying, hey, we're also ruling out the possibility there is something else, that I have seen, say, in indoor cats, or I have seen in dogs that mostly spend their time indoors. And I don't want to pursue something like allergy testing, or, you know, have them have to be on these medications if it is something that I can easily control. And you will just not win the battle sometimes. Like, as you can educate as much as you want, you can say everything right, and sometimes you will just not win.
Yeah.
But I have had clients where, you know, I've written in their discharge, like, please consider that I'm still concerned this is part of the problem. And I've brought it up at rechecks, like, you know, I know you were hesitant before, but I'm still worried. And I've had people, like, on the second or third time be like, okay, so you don't want to give up. You can do it in a very, you know, non-aggressive way. Like, you did a very kind way. Like, I'm just very still concerned. I know we talked about it before. We'll always do what you feel good about, but here are my concerns, and document it. And you can just do it in a way that's really nice. But sometimes it does take people a few times of hearing it to really kind of accept that, okay, maybe I should listen and try that. And you touched about the indoor cat thing a little bit. That was kind of the next concern, was if you have an indoor cat. So I guess I can flip that question a little bit, because another common thing I hear is, say, I have a dog that's itchy and I know has, you know, say, atopic dermatitis, and we know those dogs are predisposed to flea allergy. But say there's two indoor cats in the household that aren't itchy, but you think it's really important for them to be on flea control. How do you kind of flip that script?
So
the cats are indoor, not on flea control, but they're not itchy. But the dog, you're afraid, has a really bad flea allergy. How do you talk to the owners about the importance of the cat going on flea control?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I always bring that up, especially in a multi-pet household, that even if the other pets are totally fine and they don't have any symptoms of itch, they could still be a vector for fleas. Like, God forbid, a flea or two sneaks into the house and there's two healthy vectors for those fleas to call a home, and then you're going to have a pretty big problem. So, and yeah, that's usually how I present it to them.
Yeah. I like to say fleas love cats, and they love cats. It's where they want to be. It's called the cat flea. They love cats. So if they make their way in, they're going to be super happy. And even though the cat's not bothered, which just proves there's no infestation, because if there's a true infestation, everyone's itchy everywhere, you know, but it's just proving there's not infestation. I'm not worried that there's infestation in your household. I'm more worried that your dog is very sensitive, and any exposure can dramatically cause a response. And though the cat's not bothered by occasional exposure, it could feed onto the exposure of the dog. Or flip-flop, say, like, there's three cats in the house and only one cat's itchy. So I like to explain the differences. Like you mentioned, flea infestation does not equal flea allergy. Like, those are actually two very different things that we're dealing with. So then the last one, which I know you love, cause I know you've TikToked on it, is, and I feel like I've heard this quite a bit lately, especially with pollens coming out, and I'm trying to get everyone to bathe their dog. The thought of, well, I've been told it's not good to bathe my dog more than once a month, or I really shouldn't bathe them that often because I've heard it's really bad for their skin. What are your thoughts on that?
So this is a really good topic. And again, yes, I've mentioned it in my TikToks, because whenever I've done TikToks or reels about allergies and I emphasize the importance on topical therapy and how important bathing is, I get questions like, but wait, isn't bathing too much bad? And I always emphasize that the important thing is the product that you use, because yes, bathing can be bad if you use the incorrect product. If you buy a regular shampoo from over the counter that has soaps in it, it can dry out the skin for sure if you use it more than once or twice a month. But it's very important, again, the type of product, because the products that we use for our patients are meant to be used, even if we could, daily. Like, you can even bathe your dog as often as daily if you wanted to with these products, because They don't have any soaps in them. They're very gentle. They mainly have active ingredients that are meant for antimicrobial therapy, like chlorhexidine and antifungal. Some of them also include ceramides in them to help support the skin barrier. They help moisturize as well. So, and I love topical therapy. Me personally, I really like it. It's especially for infectious cases. It's a good alternative to using systemic antibiotics and the risk of causing resistance in bacterial infections. And I know that obviously it's not easy. I have a dog that has allergies. Thank God it's pretty mild allergies, but we tried to bathe her weekly, and bathing a bigger dog, it's a lot of work. And especially in households where there's an older owner and they can't bathe them a lot. So I'm really glad that we don't, at least in Durham, we have more options rather apart from just the shampoo. So we have sprays, mousses. But yeah, going back to the question about how often can you bathe and if it's bad or not, I always answer, it depends on the product pretty much.
Yeah. I think that's in a very important point is like, what are you using? And I think that's also where it comes to education of why we're bathing. So besides just they have an infection, maintenance bathing is extremely important. I mean, I do have a dog who's heading down the path of pretty bad allergies, I think. And she's moderately bad right now, but she's only one. And, you know, I've already allergy tested her. She is currently on Apoquil. She gets bathed once or twice a week. Like she gets ear flush. She's, I think, heading down towards being a mess.
All the work.
All the work. She picked very well her owner. But, you know, I explained to them that besides just the infection, and I want to maintain so we're not having those infections so often. So besides the fact of being, you know, topical therapy has a few different benefits, you know, yes, treating active infection when it's there, hopefully causing less frequent infections if you do maintenance bathing, but also reducing flares because you're taking pollens off the skin. We are using a lot of products that have those epidermal barrier function properties to them, you know, whether it was phytosphingosine or Ofitrium, like the new one coming out. So yeah, we have all these benefits, and allergic dog skin is not normal. Like it's mm-hmm. not normal. And so I'll tell them, even if your dog looks good genetically, their skin is not normal. So we need help, and help through topical therapy can be extremely beneficial, especially we all want to try to minimize chronic meds if we can. And sometimes you can't, but if we can reduce the infections, that's what's important. And tell owners too, like, I think the scariest thing we deal with in managing allergic patients or any derm patient are resistant infections. So like, to me, even if we're going down dilute bleach land, like saying we're have to bleach, and I know I'm probably going to cause some cirrhosis or dry skin, like, because it is dilute bleach, you know, and they won't that dry out their skin. I'm like, maybe I'm more scared of the bacteria. Like I can get you through some dry skin if that happens. If we get through the infection.
That's easy to fix.
Like there's where we get into like our topical fatty acids, and we can work with that. But infection's what I'm most scared about. So using the right product, you know, explaining that, taking the pollens off the skin can be helpful, that these actually have like precursor ceramides and things that actually help with the epidermal barrier. That tends to get people more on board, but also like seeing what they can do. People are super defeated if you send them home with an unrealistic plan. So if I send home a plan, I'm like, God, I would just love if you'd bathe twice a week. And there is no way that owner can do it, but every other week, guess what's going to probably happen? They're probably not going to do it at all. So they're going to see they missed like the first week. And then they feel like, well, we've already like messed it up. And then we're just down the road of, I'm not doing it. So that's where asking about frequency, like, I would love for you to bathe your pet once a week. Can you do that? And if they're just like, no, I could maybe have the groomer do it twice every 2 weeks, or, you know, my son can come over and do it every 2 weeks. Okay, well, let's commit to every 2 weeks, but then maybe we need to do some mousse in between because it, you know, you can't bathe all the time. So I think that's really important too, is explaining the benefit, but also realizing we have to set forth a plan. Because or else they're just going to do nothing. And how disheartening is it when you have this beautiful treatment plan they recheck with you and you're like, they should be doing great. And then it's just like, they're not. And then you find out like half the things didn't happen. Well, then I'm more disheartened by that. 'Cause I'm like, I don't know if my plan was good or not. Like you did everything I asked you to do. And then you come back and they're not better. Like I'm sad about that because my plan didn't work. However, I know what to change. I can make adjustments versus, well, you just didn't do it. Well, then I don't know. Like, then I just feel like we lost this past month and I'm going to kind of just tell you to do exactly what I told you to do last time. And we're not making any grounds in that kind of chronic management, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm really big about asking them and just being realistic. 'Cause I always try to be very empathetic with my clients. I totally understand life happens, like, especially if it's an elderly client or if it's a mom with multiple kids and they can't really focus on the dog that much. I actually had a client the other day that she came, I rechecked her pet, but I had never seen her before. She had seen somebody else. And she, as I started talking to her, she mentions, you know what? It's really, really hard for me to keep up with all this stuff that I have to do for my dog. And I try, and then I ask her, okay, how can we change that? How can we change that to make it easier for you? Because if we can't do topical, then we're going to have to resort to doing more oral and more systemic medications. And the owner was like actually pretty open about talking about that. I was like, how about if we like try to set one day a week for your dog, make it a fluffy day for the week. Like it's Fluffy's day today. She gets a bath, she gets her ears cleaned. And then after she gets bathed, you could do the spray the next day and we can incorporate mousses or sprays in between. So I'm really glad that we have so many options right now and that we can pretty much not play around, because that sounds terrible, but we actually have options to work with clients now. So it's pretty great.
Yeah. You can trial and error. And sometimes it's not set in stone. It can fluctuate. So when people go back to traveling again, you know, maybe when someone's on a trip, they can't bathe all the time, but then who's watching the dog could do a mousse to a specific area if they tend to break out. But then when the owner comes back, they're more than welcome to, you know, they're fine to bathe all the time. So being able to kind of, you know, work with your client to make sure you set up the plan that works for them at that time point is just really, really important. With that, I think you've made it. I feel like we have busted some myths. And I know there's probably more we could bust. Yes. But I just want to thank you. I know you're in the middle of your residency, so you have a lot on your plate. I'm really, really glad that we made this work and you could be on the podcast. And looking forward to hopefully more episodes in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I had a blast debunking myths with you. I think it can be pretty fun to talk about this. And I love your podcast so much. It's a great honor to be here. Honestly, I've listened to your podcast for quite a while, so it's pretty awesome.
Awesome. Well, and now you can say you've been on it, this little nerdy podcast that probably only like dermatology residents and maybe some dermatologists think is cool, but you know, we like it. So
yes.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate the love.
Yeah. Myths are busted. What a really fun way to talk about some really common topics that can make our lives in veterinary dermatology a little more difficult. But as myself and Dr. Hernandez talked about, really educating clients, finding ways to communicate with them effectively can be so essential. And you really can get these clients on your side. You can bust that myth for them so they'll really take your treatment recommendations to heart. So I just have to thank Dr. Hernandez for joining me today. It's in the midst of her busy resident schedule. As always, if you love the podcast, please leave a really positive review. It helps us reach more people. And do not forget about the Derm Nerds. It has been such an amazing community to be a part of. We're having some virtual Zoom calls to discuss topics. I put up cases of the week. I've just gotten a lot of really good positive feedback. And don't forget, there is that race accredited cytology lecture included within the membership. So if you're interested in that at all, please check out my website, thedermvet.com, and you can find the tab, The Derm Nerds. Thanks, everyone.